Hello and welcome to the live webinar, M&A, what sellers should do to make sure that the deal goes through. Sponsored by New Direction Partners, empowered by Printing Impressions and Package Printing. My name is Jeff Stout, and I am the president of PICA, the printing industry of the Carolinas, an affiliate of PIA. And I'm pleased to welcome you to today's event. Before we get started, let me take a second to point out the Tips for Attendees widget on your console. It's the blue one with the wrench on it. If you missed the Tech Tips video we played leading up to the webinar, you can always click this widget for more information. Our presenters today are Paul Riley and Tom Williams, founding partners at New Direction Partners. Paul Riley has been in the industry for over 30 years, and for the last 8 years has been providing investment banking and financial advisory services for privately held and family-owned businesses. He brings supplier experience as a senior executive at Polychrome, now part of Kodak, a worldwide supplier of printing and packaging supplies. He also brings extensive acquisition experience as CEO of Senveo, one of the industry's most active acquirers. Tom Williams draws upon his experience as a senior executive within the financial services industry to advise the clients in matters regarding creating shareholder value. Williams has extensive experience representing both buyers and sellers in merger and acquisition transactions, orchestrating workouts, restructures, and asset liquidations that maximize recovery value for stakeholders. He's a proven leader and an innovative thinker who creates and implements strategies that grow businesses beyond financial expectations. And now I'd like to hand it over to Paul Riley. Paul?
Thank you, Jeff. It's a pleasure. I appreciate everybody's time. Today we're going to talk about what a seller should do to ensure that there's a successful transaction after they have signed the letter of intent. So we're talking about starting this discussion, which is, you know, maybe 6 months or even 9 months into a selling process, what you should be doing in those last 3 to 4 months. So first, to talk about what is normally included in a letter of intent, and this represents what you have already agreed with the buyer. So a letter of intent is always non-binding. A seller can get out of it, a potential buyer can get out of it. It has the broad terms that we would include in an agreement that will be finalized at the end of due diligence. Includes terms like purchase price, payment terms and structure. Is it an asset deal? Is it a stock deal? Does all funds get paid at closing? Do some get paid in the future? Do some get paid based on continued improvement or some kind of metric that is measured in the future? It normally includes a description of the assets that are being sold and what liabilities are being assumed by the buyer. And there's something in it called a no-shop provision. That's our nomenclature for an enforceable provision that says that during the period that the buyer is doing their due diligence, that the seller will no longer talk to anybody else about selling their business. It's a very, very important clause and needs to be understood by the seller, because the buyer is spending a lot of money doing their due diligence, and in turn for spending that money, they expect the seller not to be shopping it. So first we're going to talk about, we're going to have five items that the seller must do after the letter of intent was signed, and I'm going to start off with my partner, Tom Williams, will start off our discussion here.
All right, our first point is to hire a deal lawyer and involve your accountant. In addition to your M&A advisor, you need other professionals on your team. It's imperative that there are appropriate reps and warranties, obviously, in the documentation that will memorialize the final agreement that's made. Appropriate documentation, professionally prepared, is certainly very essential in every transaction. These are not riskless transactions, and you need professional advice to minimize the risks and pitfalls as the transaction is negotiated and documented. Your advisors need to have good deal experience, and this, in my opinion, is of paramount importance. I think Paul has some examples.
Yeah, the lessons that we have seen, that we've learned over a period of time, is that a deal lawyer, and, you know, their deal is our nomenclature, but in the legal world, they're called transaction lawyers. They have a different set of skills than, for instance, a real estate lawyer. Had a client. We represented the buyer in this case, and the seller hired a good friend and somebody that did several real estate transactions for the seller. This lawyer did not have any experience in understanding the risk that gets shared between a buyer and seller in a normal business transaction. Now, I'm sure everybody on the line has done a real estate transaction in their life, and there's little or no risk. I mean, relative to, because people own the land, you have insurance for that, it's a good title, there's a significant amount of risk that has been taken out. In the case of a sale of a transaction, of sale of a business, that's not the case. There may be future payments that are at risk. There's also a concept within a business sale, and Tom talked about it, reps and warranties. And in the reps and warranties, the seller says, I guarantee you, I warrant to you, the buyer, that I don't know any bad things that are happening, and those bad things could be things he knows of or things he doesn't know of. And if you're not a lawyer involved in understanding how you manage that, sometimes you misadvise your client. In fact, in the case I just talked about, the real estate counsel for the company our client was looking to buy wouldn't accept any risk, and because of that, the deal fell apart. There's also, Tom mentioned, a tax accountant. There are significant tax ramifications to the sale of your business. Usually the person that does your taxes is qualified to do the taxes that are involved with reporting the sale of a business. So we would also recommend that right after you sign your letter of intent, even if not before, you start to get your tax accountant involved in the transaction. Okay. So let us go to number two. And number two is make your numbers. If there is one item that causes transactions not to happen, this is the item. So many times, and most times, a buyer of a company is counting on, they're banking on, that the seller is going to make the projections that were provided prior to them signing the letter of intent, or if there were no projection provided, there was either a budget or there was a level of sales and income that the buyer said, this is what I'm doing. If during the process you find that the numbers are falling away, it's a very, very difficult situation. The buyer doesn't know your business, and he doesn't know how, she doesn't know how far your numbers will fall. You, obviously, as a seller, think things are going to come back. So it's a very, very difficult situation. So the point here is that it's very, very important to make your numbers while you are selling your business. Tom, I think you may have some takeaways here as you want to discuss.
I think there are a couple of takeaways from this discussion. Number one, obviously, is don't inflate your projections. You're much better off if your projections that are presented to the buyer are conservative, numbers you know that you're going to be able to accomplish. Otherwise, you've put yourself in a position where a deal could potentially fall apart. The other advice or takeaway, I think, would be to try to sell your business during positive trends. If the business is trending up, you're going to get a lot more interest. You know, buyers are going to be less likely to try to negotiate a low price, et cetera. It's kind of common sense, but selling a company when the trends are negative is obviously a difficult task. If we go on to point three,
I think, Jeff, you have a question, Jeff?
Oh, yeah, did you?
Yeah, what happens if they don't make their numbers? Can the transaction be salvaged?
Well, the answer is sometimes yes and sometimes no. I guess that means depends. Couple of options. If it's a very temporary change, maybe you wait a month and the numbers come back and that would be fine. The most likely item to have is that the seller has to deal with a price reduction. The price of the company is going to go down, or some portion of the purchase price will be delayed, won't be paid until the profits fall back to where they were before they fell. So the answer is they can, and often that's the role of the investment banker to salvage these loans, but it's usually not a good thing for the seller when numbers go south in the middle of a transaction. Tom?
Yeah, we move on to number three, respond to due diligence requests on a timely basis. The first thing the buyer is going to do after a letter of intent is presented and accepted is provide the seller with a very detailed list of due diligence items. This is when they're going to do their investigation. They're going to look very, very deeply into the company's detailed records and obviously use the information that they glean from the due diligence process to design, if you will, the final transaction details and terms. Could you move to the next slide, Jeff?
I did. Hold it. There we go.
There we go. Here is a list of some of the key items that you're going to be asked to provide to a buyer. It's obvious they're going to want detailed financial information, going back at least 3 years, sometimes much further, depending on the situation. They're going to want to examine your tax returns. They want to compare budgets, you know, versus actual results. You're going to have to disclose if there's any active litigation, if there is pending litigation, if there is a situation where litigation is imminently possible. If the building is, if there's real estate that's part of a transaction, all the details relative to that real estate will have to be disclosed. Any contracts that you have with clients, contracts with vendors, et cetera, copies of all of those contracts will have to be provided. If the company has intellectual property as an asset on their balance sheet, could be, you know, software that was developed by the company, patents that the company owns relative to product design and things of that nature, obviously that needs to be disclosed and provided. All of your HR files and records, details on the employee benefit packages, copies of all the documentation relative to health care plans, 401ks, et cetera. Also, cost and pricing detail regarding, you know, all of the aspects of the process of quoting your work and what the final results are in your financial statements. Client details and trends, they're going to want to know all about your clients, obviously who they are, how much business is generated by those clients. One issue that does make a company more difficult to sell is when there is significant concentration with one or two accounts. So that is a negative. Environmental issues come into play today. So if there are environmental issues with the property, it needs to be disclosed. If there have been phase one or phase two, you know, environmental reports, they need to be disclosed. If there is a lease or leases that will be assumed or have to be renegotiated as part of the sale, those details obviously have to be disclosed as well. Your IT systems, you know, all the detail regarding systems are key to any transaction. And I think the ownership details need to be disclosed because, believe it or not, this can kill a deal if there's a stakeholder, a shareholder, a family member, or someone else that has some portion of ownership or some control over the business, and they come out of the woodwork at the closing, which, you know, has happened in my experience, where undisclosed stakeholders have basically killed a deal at the closing table. Paul, do you want to expand on that?
Yeah, let me drill down on a couple of items here. First of all, I would imagine to many of the people on the line that you'd look at this list and say, that's a bit daunting. And it very much is. That is why it is always our recommendation to our client that they only go into due diligence with one company, that you get to a point where you negotiate your best deal at the letter of intent, then you go to due diligence and you do it to one person. Clearly, there's a big burden, as you see here, on the financial person within your organization. And there's just nothing we can do about that. It's going to be a significant job for the financial person in your organization. I would also add if there's multiple people from the seller and buyer involved in due diligence, we recommend a weekly due diligence meeting where all parties get on the phone, they go through the list of due diligence requests, and actually ask for where is this data? When can I get it? There's an expectation I'll get it in this period of time. So we find that to be very, very healthy. There's also a question about customers. There are times, particularly, I think, you know, Tom talked about high level concentrations, when the buyer believes that there is a chance that a major customer will not be happy with the transaction, that just prior to closing, that both the buyer and seller go meet the client, the customer of the seller, and decide if they're going to be happy with it. It's not something we see all the time, but when it does happen, it happens usually just an hour or two before closing. The one item before, and I think we have a couple of questions we can then handle, is in the world of printing, there isn't what we call much of a liability tail. It's not like you're making products that can blow up or there's product liability. But the one area today where we do see a tail, the tail meaning that after the company is sold, some liability manifests itself and the new owner has to deal with it. It normally has to do with labor law and has to do frequently with a unfair termination claim by somebody within the organization. So this item about HR files and looking at employee benefits is increasingly becoming a major focus of due diligence. Jeff, you got a couple questions for us?
Yeah, I do. First is, how long is the typical due diligence period? If you want to address that first, and then I'll ask the second.
Yeah, let me go that. It's normally outlined in the letter of intent. Sometimes we see it as short as 75 days. Some people put in shorter periods. We rarely achieve the shorter periods. A typical period is like 90 days. And at the beginning of the process, the buyer sometimes asks for the right to go as long as 120 days. So it's not something that happens in a period of weeks. If there is an exception to that, if there is a transaction when it's nothing more than what we would refer to as a tuck-in, we could probably spend another seminar on that, but a tuck-in is when essentially the buyer is just looking at the customer base, possibly the due diligence period can be 60 days. But a typical, I'm buying the entire company as is, it's a good 90-day period.
Okay, great. Thanks. Yeah, another question. As we all know, quite often you see problems with successful post-transaction integration is cultural differences. How do buyers typically do their due diligence on cultural differences between the buyer and seller's businesses?
Well, you know, this starts at the beginning of the process. When a buyer first meets a potential seller, they are measuring, are the two organizations going to get along afterwards? There's no checklist here. There's nothing that, fill in these 10 points. It's very much a function of how the buyer feels the interaction is going between his or her team and the seller's team. Is there a meeting of the minds, particularly as to how the business will be run post-closing? If there isn't a meeting of mind, there's a differences of opinion, you know, that would be a sign that the cultural differences are too difficult to surround, to get over with. If you have a company that is totally growth-oriented, you know, they're not very manufacturing or process-oriented, that may not be a good match with a company whose total focus is lean manufacturing. But it is something where it begins at the first interaction between the buyer and seller, and it continues all the way up and through closing that the buyer makes that determination, is there going to be a cultural fit. Unfortunately, some buyers don't consider it sufficiently enough. They think they can deal with it afterwards in making it.
Yeah. One other question, Paul. What percentage of your buyers require that they meet with top customers prior to closing? Is that common?
You can help. I think it's less than 10% the area. It almost always happens if there's a high level of concentration where one or two customers represent, let's say, 40% or more of sales. It will happen. But I would say in the 10%. Maybe as of late, trading a little bit higher, but it doesn't happen every time, that's for sure. Tom, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think you're pretty much on the money. If there is a deal concentration, I would say in almost 100% of the cases, the buyer is very concerned and wants to ensure that business is going to transfer to the new ownership. Where concentration is not an issue, I'd say typically, although there are exceptions, it's not a major issue. But it always happens at the very last minute after the deal is imminent and just prior to closing.
Yeah, and the reason why that's the case, Tom, I'm glad you brought up that point, is that there's a little bit of friction, there's a little bit of a concern in talking to a customer about there's going to be a change of management or a change of ownership. And there's no reason to unnecessarily raise the seller's customers to that potential issue unless there is 100% chance that the deal is going to go through if the customer says yes. So these customer contacts would always happen just before, and many times just the day before, even early in the day of, that the announcement goes public. Jeff, before we move on to the next slide, do you have any more questions?
Actually, I've got two more, Paul. One is, are there any special considerations when buying or selling a print brokerage?
In some ways, no, but it's a different transaction. In some ways, a subset of a transaction if you're buying a company that would have manufacturing assets. So the focus of the due diligence when you're selling a print brokerage tends to be obviously the customers, but also the technology that's being used for those customers, including obviously the salespeople, but you're going to have that in other case. So it's more than it's different. It's more it's a subset of what would be done with a larger due diligence. But because that's all being purchased, you do tend to see that there is always a lot of work being done on the customer side and the customer technology interface side.
Okay. And just one more quick question. With such a competitive industry, what protection does the seller have to protect its customer information from poaching from a competitor during due diligence?
Excellent question. It's actually protected way before then. Our recommendation is that no confidential information is given to a prospective buyer until that buyer signs a non-disclosure agreement. That non-disclosure agreement will have provisions that the buyer will not contact any customer, any supplier, any employee that they learned about during the process. And that document carries over through the letter of intent all the way through into the completion of due diligence. So that concern, real concern, there are segments within our industry where that's more concerned than others, but a seller must protect themselves contractually about that risk way up early in the process before they disclose any confidential information to potential buyers.
Yeah, and those agreements also have a tail on them so that the buyer, if the deal doesn't close, is enjoined from contacting, the company, sellers, employees, et cetera, for a period of many times up to 2 years after the deal falls apart if it doesn't close.
Right. Excellent question. Okay, we're moving on to the fourth of five things a seller must do to ensure a successful transaction. And this is develop a communication plan. This is the most overlooked part of the acquisition process by both buyers and sellers, driven by a variety of things, but this is essential for a successful transaction. Usually, in fairness, the seller is somebody who goes along with it, is part of communicating, but the leadership of a communication plan should come from the buyer. And it includes things like why this transaction is happening, what's going to happen to the employees, what's going to happen to the facilities. But regardless of all of that, The most important part of a communication plan is to explain to the customers why this transaction is good for the customers. If you cannot express that to your customer base, I guarantee you the competitors will, and they'll explain to them why this acquisition is bad. So it is imperative that a seller and a buyer work together, put together a clear communication plan that explains mostly to your customers, because they're most important, as to why this acquisition is going to be good for them. If you're involved in a transaction and you have trouble answering the question, you can't answer this question, why is this transaction good for your customers? You've got to be really careful about entering into it. Jeff, any questions before we go to our last point?
One question here, Paul. Do sellers normally compensate employees for differences in salary if the buyer's cost structure is less for this component of cost, particularly when it comes to sales commissions?
Good question. first of all, if a seller is dealing with a buyer who is representing to the seller that it's the buyer's intention to reduce the compensation of his key employees going forward, you should have really concerns about doing that deal. I have this rule of thumb about implementation, and I feel very strongly about it because I think as Jeff alluded to earlier, I have been involved as a buyer of over 250 printing facilities, and I made some mistakes. And the mistakes I made always seem to be around doing anything to change the relationship between the customers and the frontline employees, which in our industry is the salespeople and CSRs that deal with that client every day. So we recommend to our clients and to our purchases of our clients that they make as few changes as possible in that area for a period of time, 6 months, a year, it's something like that. So first of all, my first answer to the question is we shouldn't be making changes. I don't think I've ever seen a situation where the seller cuts a check because the buyer wants to reduce the salary of an employee going forward. I just haven't seen it. Sometimes, many times, we do see that if the seller has non-owner employees who are important parts of getting the company sold successfully, that they would get a bonus for selling the business and helping it be sold. But I can't recall that ever happened. I don't know about you, Tom.
No, I think, you know, there are a lot of situations, obviously, where we might have a high labor rate buyer buying a lower labor rate facility in a right-to-work state, you know, outside a major metropolitan area. And there's really no issue there because, obviously, the seller's employees are going to be compensated going forward at a level that's equal to or greater than what historically they've received. And, I agree with Paul, obviously. You can't come in and reduce people's compensation, sales commissions, or things of that nature, or else, the ill will created by that can destroy the morale, et cetera, in an operation and have very, very negative results.
Jeff, any more questions?
Not at this point.
Okay, so let us go to our last slide. Tom?
Our last slide essentially is think about life after closing. And I think any seller has to, focus on this. Every situation is different. It's very, very common, particularly with privately held companies, that the buyer is going to want key management, whether it's the owner or other key people, obviously, to take part in an orderly transition of the business. The transition, obviously, can be somewhat lengthy in certain situations. So it's very common that the seller is going to be required by the buyer to, sign on for a transition period. A year is not unusual. Sometimes it's for a longer period of time. Sometimes, particularly if the owner controls a significant amount of sales volume, there's either a commission agreement or a consulting agreement that's entered into with that person that I've seen them, as long as 5 years. If the seller has no intention of being with the business long term after the sale, which is a very usual situation, he needs to make those desires known to the buyer up front so that whatever's negotiated for a transition period doesn't become a problem later on in the deal process. We do have sellers that do want to remain with their business for some reason long term. A more typical situation is where a seller has children in the business, and the children wish to remain with the business. And again, that's a situation that needs to be brought to light early on in the transaction process, because the buyer obviously has to look carefully at those employees, particularly the family members, and determine, whether or not they want those people involved in the business after closing. Many of our sellers obviously are reaching retirement age, which is the primary reason that they put the business up for sale. And the successful retirement stories are the fellows or ladies who have a real good plan for what they're going to do. Paul and I sold a company a couple of years ago, and the seller's plan and what he did was to become a farmer. A gentleman in his early 50s wanted to be a farmer, and that was the driving force for selling his company. And he sold the company successfully. He had already purchased a farm, and he's living happily ever after doing what his dream was. The biggest problem we see with sellers that sell their business and don't have a plan is they just kind of flounder around and kind of lost direction. They're bored. They don't have other activities outside of the business. And that's not a good thing. So if you're a seller, have a plan and know what you want to do and where you want to go and how you're going to stay active.
Tom, I would add that certainly a consideration for any seller post-closing is that they now have a boss. And they have to come to realize that that's different. And part of committing to have a successful transition of the business is for that seller to commit that they will work for somebody else, and that can be difficult for some people. I think most people deal with it, but it's a change in the way you go to work every day. And one of Tom's and my partner calls it the proverbial walk on the beach, and he advises his clients to take a couple of days off, walk on the beach, and understand what life's going to be like after closing. Very, very important part of a sales process for family-owned businesses like the ones that we mostly represent. Jeff, I see a question out there.
Yes. How much are buyers today requiring that the sellers keep in the business, you know, either through a seller note or rolling equity? If rolling equity, what's typical, and what percentage of buyers just buy 100% at closing?
Well, you know, the range is 0%. I mean, there are certainly many transactions where the check comes at closing. I'm not counting in escrow. I mean, there's always some amount of an acquisition that's held back, some specifically for escrow, and that can be anywhere from 5 to 10% of the purchase price of the company. So in one end, we have zero. On the very high end, you know, it could be 50, 60%. And if it's anything like 50 to 60%, the transaction has been structured in what we call a tuck-in, where effectively the seller sells their business and gets three payments. One gets a payment for working capital at closing. Another one, they sell their equipment, sometimes to the buyers, sometimes at auction. And the third one is they get paid a commission on sales over a period of time, and that can be anywhere from 3 to 5 years. And that latter case, when it is that sort of business, you can see 50 to 60%. If your company is being purchased by a private equity firm, and this is increasingly we are seeing that, and this is actually good news for the print industry. We are seeing private equity come back into it, coming back even into the commercial markets. Normally, the management team going forward will be asked to leave in the business a significant amount of money. And a significant amount of money varies by person. If it's a very wealthy person, they want a lot of money. If it's not a wealthy person, as long as it's a significant commitment to that person, they are happy with that. And today, in most cases, a private equity firm, on top of what is left in the business, they'll normally give the management team about 20% of the increase in the value of the company post-closing to the management team. So not 20% of all of the value, but 20% of the increase in the value from closing. And normally the of the 20%, 25% to 5% of the total of that goes to the senior executive, the CEO. Tom, any other insights there?
No, I think if it's a going concern sale, obviously there's, much more money up front and less money on any contingent basis after the closing. And as you pointed out, if it's not a going concern sale, there's a very high percentage, relatively speaking, that obviously is payable after closing in some way, shape, or form.
Jeff, any questions?
Yes. Other than increasing profits and lowering debts, are there other ways or better ways to increase the value of a printing company before bringing it to market?
There's a lot in those two words. I think there is it's the driver of those. If you're a going concern, you, in our industry, in many industries, you were sold as a multiple of EBITDA, which is a measurement of cash flow. Both Tom and I could tell you all of the problems with EBITDA, but we can also tell you everybody does it. So we can't fight that battle. That multiple, which will be applied to your profits, will go up the more the company is growing. So if you're a company that's $10 million and you got a $1 million EBITDA and you've been $10 million, for a long period of time, that company would sell at a lower multiple than a company that is $10 million, has $1 million of EBITDA, but last year it was $9 million in sales and it grew 11%. So the growth of your business, the perception of that it will continue to grow is the other major item that you can manage, you can work on to improve the value of your company. I see somebody has a question on EBITDA. So EBITDA stands for, I'm sorry, no, go.
Go for it.
Okay, go for it. Earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, amortization, EBITDA. So the way you normally compute that is that you start with your pre-tax income, or if you have pay taxes, you start with your tax, your after-tax income, add back your income taxes. You don't add back real estate taxes. You add back your income taxes. You add back your interest, and then you add back your depreciation and amortization. That number is EBITDA. In a family-owned business, Tom and I will frequently sit down with the owners and talk about making pro forma adjustments to that EBITDA. And they have to do with family expenses. They have to do with one-time events. Essentially, we would identify those expenses that will go away post-closing that would have happened if the business was not going to be sold. So it's a metric that increasingly is used by not only buyers, but your banker. Your banker knows your EBITDA, and they're going to be looking at your EBITDA, comparing it to debt levels. And for what that's worth in the printing industry, if your debt is higher than three times your EBITDA, your bank is not going to be happy with you. So that's what EBITDA stands for, and it is the almost universal measurement of a company's cash flow that's used for pricing a transaction.
Okay. If the seller is losing money, how do you value the business? EBITDA doesn't seem to work at that point. Any thoughts?
Well, you go back to that point that Tom talked about, saying that says you sold on a non-going concern or a tuck-in. And when a tuck-in is looked at, a buyer will say, I will pay the value of your business. That's the sum of the next three items. Your working capital. So your working capital is your receivables, your inventory, your prepaids, less your accounts payable and accrued liabilities. They pay for that at closing, or the seller realizes it by just liquidating it at closing. The second piece is the value of your equipment. The buyer may want some of it. The buyer may want all of it. The buyer may want none of it. But whatever it is, normally the seller will realize the orderly liquidation value of that business. And the third is this commission that we alluded to, which is the a commission, a royalty. It's the value of your customer base. And it's a very, very important number. And I will tell you that Tom and I, we met with our partners over the last couple of weeks, and we're looking at trends. And we believe there's good news here in that the value that's paid for your customer base appears to be increasing. And I would say today we would be looking at receiving somewhere between 4 and 7% of sales 3 to 5 years. So it's a significant part of your number. And that's today how a company that doesn't have EBITDA or has very low EBITDA is being sold. And, you know, maybe half of all transactions in the printing businesses are actually priced that way. Tom, anything you would add?
No, I think you're right on spot. And as Paul said, we've had some extensive discussions about that based on our seven partners and directors' experience in the last 6 to 8 months. And it can be, in certain cases, well over $1 million payout over time, on a $4 or $5 million book of sales.
Jeff, any more questions?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, this is a common one among the attendees. What's the current multiple used today for valuing a commercial printer, and does that change based on the size of the company?
Well, the answer to the last one was yes, and the answer to the first one depends.
Okay.
So let me be more precise than that. The larger the organization, the larger the EBITDA multiple. And it has to do with the demand. The larger the transaction, the more demand we see. A couple of breaks in it. If we see a EBITDA of $5 million, we would see about a half a turn increase in EBITDA multiple. So if it was 4, it's 4.5. If it was 5, it'd be 5.5. If it's, you had above $10 million in EBITDA, and that's obviously a fairly large printing company in today's world, it would be a full 1 point increase in EBITDA. Now, what is the EBITDA multiple? Well, there's a big difference today between commercial printers and packaging companies. Commercial printers, if we were having this conversation 6-9 months ago, we would say maybe 3, maybe a little bit above 3. We see the market increasing. There is an improvement. So today it's more like 4. So if you have a 6 or 7 million in commercial print company, you know, doing marketing collateral, like most commercial print companies, not growing, relatively flat, you may see EBITDA multiples in the 4 range. If there's some concentration of customer base, we may see it come down a little bit below the 4. But it is increasing, which is good news. On the other side, if you're a packaging company and it's not growing, it may be a 6 times EBITDA, 5 times EBITDA, certainly, and fast-growing packaging companies we see is 6 and 7 and some even more than that. So it really depends upon what market segment you're in. The good news, generally speaking, throughout the world, throughout the different niches we're in, we see EBITDA multiples increasing.
Another question. You mentioned the increase in private equity interest within the industry. Do you see many sales to form ESOPs?
Any sales to – I'm not so sure I understand the question. To we are seeing sales of ESOP companies to private equity and to strategic buyers. So so we have been involved in several of those over the past 18 months.
Okay.
If you say, have we seen a trend, and I can't say I had, Tom, maybe you could add, have we seen an increase in the trend of companies to become ESOPs? They still remain to be far, few in between, and I don't have any knowledge of any recent ones.
No, I don't have any knowledge of recent ESOP deals. I mean, as far as, selling a portion of the company to the employees, I've actually seen a couple of my clients raise cash to buy out the ESOP and get rid of it.
I've clearly been involved in a couple of those, so that's happening. So certainly that's happened because, you know, we are finally seeing some loosening in the lending markets, which is a good sign for everybody. And I think that's one of the factors that is increasing multiples. And the other is the one we alluded to earlier, is that increasingly interest by private equity firms, I think, is also helping the demand for printing companies and certainly packaging companies as well.
Here's another question. Is there a quantitative relationship between risk factors, such as concentration, major capex required, management depth, audited financials, et cetera, on purchase multiples. So is there a quantitative relationship between risk factors on purchase multiples?
The answer is no. It's there, though. It's not something that we've been able to quantify and say it's worth a half a point or a point. We would say the negative items that we are seeing today include concentration, high turnover in management, management not committed to the business, and unions, and particularly any company with the union, and that the transaction may trigger a union withdrawal liability, and could also be a session on their own. But under current law, if a company is sold and the multi-employer union plan is underfunded at the time of sale, some of those funds will have to go to the union plan to cover the seller's proportion of that unfunded liability. That number could be very high, and quite honestly, in some cases, it's actually killed the deal because the amount of the liability due to the union plan made the sale of the company unattractive to the seller. But no quantitative analysis, we can say that now. The quantitative analysis we see tends to be with the two factors we talk about, size and growth of the business.
Okay, one other question. With all the different professional advisors needed to guide the sale of a printing business, which professional, attorney, CPA, et cetera, would be the starting point to advise the business seller? Who do you start with?
I don't know. I think, did I put that question in?
No, you did not.
certainly, it's somebody who understands the value of your business. You got to start there. You need all of those advisors, but we would highly recommend that even if not our company, that you do speak with somebody who understands your market. And sometimes we see there's a local city broker who understands manufacturing businesses, and they talk to a local printer, and they really don't understand the printing business. So I think it's important that you start with somebody who understands the investment banking side of the printing business. That person can explain to you value, the process, who the likely buyers are, how long the process will take, what kind of involvement will the seller need to stay with. So that would be the place to start. Before you make any definitive decisions, I would certainly talk to both your accountant so he can explain to you the tax consequences of the sale, and to have a lawyer who will help you with the legal ramifications as well. Particularly when you get to a letter of intent, have your lawyer look at the letter of intent. Even if it's non-binding, I'd still have your lawyer look at it.
Okay. And I'm looking at the question queue here. Let's see. Are there any best strategies, to begin to look at family transitions within the printing business? Or is that another webinar?
You can help me. It's not another one, but it's to start early, because selling your company is one of several exit. Somebody just alluded to an ESOP could be one. Moving it to the next generation could be another. It's a process that you need to spend time with, because even if you decide to sell your business, when you decide to sell your business, it's probably 9 months to a year before it happens. And then if the buyer wants you to stay on for a year or two, it could be 3 years from that point before you spend any time on the beach. So start early would be the best advice I would give in terms of looking at the opportunities in front of you.
Okay.
Yeah, I think if you're, you know, selling your business to your family, you obviously will need professional advice, I think, as far as in your situation, how the transaction should be structured.
All righty. Tom and Paul, you all have done an awesome job today, and it looks like we're just about out of time here. If there are any other questions that are lingering out there, I'm sure we'll get those answered offline. On behalf of New Direction Partners and Printing Impressions and Package Printing, I want to thank you all for attending today's webinar. Be sure to check out Printing Impressions' webinar page to get information on all their archived and upcoming programs. Please also take just a minute to fill out the brief feedback survey that will appear on your screen next. We would be grateful for you to do that. Your feedback will influence the webinars that we bring to you in the future. I hope to see you all at the next Printing Impressions and Package Printing webinar. Thank you very much for attending today.